so long.
Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And I'm gone away on down the road so long.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mr. Morpheus? Do y'all like music? Mr. Morpheus is a one-man band whose style is of the same grit and grace which shaped hillbilly music and blues of the early 1900s. He sings and whistles as he plays the guitar, harmonica, and kazoo, all while playing the bass drum and tambourine with his feet. More can be found at mrmorpheus.blogspot.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South, our Season 8 finale show, where Southerners bring their own true best stories of the year to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show and prizes are sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Little Rock native Mark Simpson was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Laraya Eubanks, and our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled The Porch, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Laraya at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some winning Southern-style storytelling? Tonight is part one of our Season 8 finale, featuring two of our four runners-up and the first of our two grand prize winners. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. So let's start the night with runner-up Kay Fisher's story of a long line and a short farewell in A Private Goodbye.
I guess we thought we were the only people going to see the President of the United States on November 25th, 1963, lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington. Instead, we ran smack into a non-ending line of people and were told it would be at least 5 or 6 hours to work our way up to the entrance of the rotunda. I was 8.5 months pregnant. For 2 days, my husband Bob, our two best friends, and I had been glued to the TV in our tiny New York apartment. First to watch the parade in Dallas, then in disbelief at the news of the shooting, the shots being tracked to the book depository, and then doctors from Parkland Hospital explaining that the president was dead. When we saw the dignitaries file past the casket, our president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, we couldn't bear to not be there to say goodbye to our hero. So at noon that day, with no money, no luggage, and no place to stay, the four of us squashed into our blue Volkswagen Bug convertible and headed to Washington. Bob drove as fast as our little car could take us, and we raced into D.C. in under 4 hours. None of us knew our way around or how to get to the rotunda. And there was the issue of where we were going to stay. We were somewhere in downtown when all of a sudden, Bob slammed on the brakes, turned the car around in the middle of bumper-to-bumper traffic, pulled over to the curb in front of a hotel, and ran inside the lobby. It turned out to be one of the finest hotels in town and was within walking distance of the rotunda. Bob quickly came out beaming like a Cheshire cat and exclaimed that the hotel had one room left and it had two double beds. We couldn't believe our luck. Of course, we took it, grabbed the keys, and left on foot for the rotunda. Details like how we were going to pay for the room would have to come later. On the Capitol grounds, we got in line. By this time, it was around 4 p.m., and none of us had eaten lunch that day. But food was the last thing on our minds, including mine, even though I was eating for two. It quickly became evident that once you were in line, there was no going anywhere, including to the bathroom. And we weren't in any position to pay to move up faster, though we saw people do that. We were either going to wait in line or our husbands would be beaten to the ground for cutting in. It just wasn't done. It was 1963 and people behaved. There was no pushing, no yelling, no sound. It was all quiet and very reverent. We began to chat with people in front and in back of us, and we came from everywhere, all states, all makes and sizes. There was a group of nuns in their habits in front of us, and not being Catholic, we brazenly asked all sorts of questions about how they thought their church would react to losing President Kennedy. Once they learned I was from the Deep South, and had gone off to college from Pine Bluff, Arkansas in 1957, when Little Rock Central High School was integrated, they had lots of questions. I told them everything I remembered about that awful fall and how disgusting I thought it was. We stood and we stood and we stood. We snaked forward truly at a snail's pace after hours. We could actually see the rotunda, and it gave us heart. Then the sun went down, and it got cold, really cold. The night got blacker and blacker, colder and colder. To pass the time, we continued to talk to those around us and cry off and not one person gave up and left. It was now approaching 9 p.m., and my back was killing me as my whole frame was off center with the extra pounds of the baby, and I could no longer feel my feet. But we didn't dare give up any of our four spots. All in all, we were in line 9 hours. Finally, at 1 a.m., we got into the rotunda, and I don't know what we expected. The first thing that hit us once we were actually in that space was the sweet, intoxicating scent of the thousands of roses and lilies that filled the room. And then we saw it. It was the most gorgeous casket I had ever seen, draped with a huge American flag. It all took my breath away and I gasped. Then the tears started. In a matter of 10 short steps, I reached the spectacular cherry wood box. I had never seen anything like it. Shiny brass rails gleamed down its sides. We were allowed to move past it very, very slowly. The casket was surrounded by United States Marines, and the rotunda itself had more Marines standing at attention along the walls. It struck me that they had crisp white gloves on. The casket shone in that light as though it were a work of art, not a coffin that held the president. I suddenly had an overwhelming need to touch the coffin. We all must have felt it because that's what everyone did. It was such a personal way to say our private goodbyes, as though it mattered. When I walked up to it about 10 paces from the door, I slipped my hand under the flag, and just for 1 second, I felt its magic. It was a holy experience. In a matter of 15 seconds, we were out on the other side. There was not to be one more second allowed to stand or pray, or certainly not to take a photo. It was just all so very sad and silent. The only sound was the click of the rifles as the Marines moved them from one shoulder to the other while standing as honor guards. Once we foregathered on the other side, there was nothing to say or do. We staggered back to the hotel and all fell into bed, trying to find sleep, with nothing but our silent feelings about what we had done and seen. The next day, the coffin was to be taken out of the rotunda, down Pennsylvania Avenue, and past the White House to its final resting place in Arlington National Cemetery. The four of us decided that I was to go and stay at the home of a Stanford classmate of my husband's and watch it with her on her TV while the three of them went to the final parade. Through the expert work of all the TV cameramen, I was able to watch their progress as they followed the cortege. The three of them actually saw John salute his father. They saw the riderless horse with the tall, gleaming black leather boots turned backward in the stirrups to symbolize a fallen warrior. Most of all, once the caisson passed them, they saw Mrs. Kennedy walking down the middle of the street holding on to Bobby Kennedy. Her face was hidden by a thick black veil, thick enough that no one could see her, but she could see the hundreds of thousands lining every inch of the streets all the way to Arlington National Cemetery. How would she or Caroline or John ever forget it? Once everything progressed from Pennsylvania Avenue toward Arlington, our little group met once again to make the long ride back home to New York in silence. I'll never forget it.
Kay Hunley Fisher, a Little Rock native, has returned after a 50-year absence. She met and married Bob in 1963, and he taught her to go, to travel at the drop of a hat, to learn and to experience our world with all its faults and its glories. Next, runner-up Martha Eshelman takes a chance and things get heated in the Warrior Round.
Miguel and I sat in his apartment, listening to the traffic outside while drinking Jack and Coke and discussing weighty issues like whose girlfriend had misbehaved the most the past week. The conversation turned to his upcoming sweat ceremony, a time of purification for his next step in his transition to fully becoming a man. He suddenly turned to me and said, "Tio, would you like to come?" Well, up until that moment, he hadn't asked me because he knew I was Episcopalian. And the most radical thing I had ever done was wear cargo shorts and flip-flops to the Eucharist. But I was thrilled, honored. Instantly, I said, "Of course." Miguel hugged me, told me a summary of what would happen in the ceremony, and then said, matter-of-factly, "Well, you don't have to be naked." What? My stomach did a somersault, but Miguel never blinked. Nothing ever fazed him. He said, okay, don't worry about it, Tio. It'll be okay. Just don't wear underpants." I was like, "What?" Miguel then explained the spirit would be flowing through me and it needed an exit point. Any good Episcopalian would have chosen the ear as the exit point. As I left his apartment, my mind was swirling with thoughts of myself on a dirt floor in the dark without underpants, keeping company with half-naked persons I barely knew, and a spirit of some sort exiting my body in a rather uncomfortable location. As Miguel would say, "It'll be okay." So I took a deep breath, put my trust in him, went home, and began to pack. The next day, we arrived at the Fire Om Earth Retreat Center in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Lorna, the leader of our ceremony, met our group, and we went out to meet the ancestors and prepare the lodge. In the opening near the lodge, there was an enormous fire, crackling, hissing, flames licking up into the sky. And inside it, you could see those ancestors, the sacred rocks, heating up and glowing bright. It was near this fire that we began Miguel's sacred ceremony. By 10 o'clock, Miguel had finished his first set of prayers. He had blown the conch shell to the north, south, east, and west. Each of us had smoked the ceremonial pipe. The ancestors were ready now, and the sweat lodge had been constructed. It was time to remove our sandals and be covered in sage smoke and enter the lodge. I was waiting to enter when I overheard several folks discussing their past sweat experiences. These people obviously loved sweat ceremonies, loved the heat of the last round. I overheard them call each other the sweat hogs. I couldn't help but think, here I was a sweat piglet, and my inaugural sweat was about to begin. After we found our seats in the dirt, the first seven ancestors were brought into the lodge, and the flap was shut. At first, the lodge was dark and silent, and actually rather cool. I had no idea what to expect, what I should do, when I should pray out loud or to myself. Thankfully, Lorna guided our way through each round. By the end of the first three rounds, the lodge was beginning to get hot and fill with steam, and 21 ancestors glowed brightly in the middle. We prayed collectively and individually and focused on Miguel. Charlotte, Miguel's friend, recited the 23rd Psalm from memory. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The experience was indeed spiritual and mystical, but the heat was rising. I looked around and realized that some people had removed some clothing. Others were settling in the dirt. I myself was still clothed, despite the layer of sweat that covered my skin. Though I tried to still my mind, I was full of questions. Had I, in fact, chosen the heaviest cotton t-shirt in my closet? Were those women over there naked or half naked? Could I keep my composure if that man's knee slimed me one more time? Well, finally, it was time for the fourth and final round. All things considered, I thought I was doing pretty well. I had made it through the first three rounds, no problem. How bad could this last round really get? I was about to find out. David, the firekeeper, announced he had a surprise for us, and then proceeded to bring into the lodge every remaining ancestor, and perhaps even a few from Oklahoma, because the pile now seemed to be 4 feet high. The flap was shut. Immediately and dramatically, the temperature increased, and I quickly scooted back against the sapling frame. Before the first ladle of water was poured on top of the ancestors, I was starting to roast. I briefly thought about my t-shirt and how it sealed the heat against my skin. No, I would continue to be my piglet self and leave it on. Then Lorna spoke. This is the final round. This is the warrior round. You can leave if you must, but try to stay in. Roar like the lions in Africa. Howl like the wolves on the Lakota Plains. Stay in. And then she began to beat a drum and sing a Lakota song, her gravelly voice chanting a native tongue. And steam began to fill the anipi until I almost couldn't see anyone on the other side. Through the heavy mist, I did see Miguel on his knees, arms stretched to the sky, soaking in the heat of his purification. But for me, each minute brought more heat, more steam, more sweat, more thoughts of pulling back that flap for a rush of cool air. I was almost certain I would not be able to honor Miguel and stay in. I sat upright, heart pounding, sweat dripping off my nose. I stared at that water ladle, willing it to stop, begging for the ancestors to stop their heat and steam. I couldn't escape this physical torment. I tried everything to escape the overwhelming heat. I sat up, I laid down, I rolled in the dirt. I even stuck my hand outside through a small crack in the inipi wall. Nothing. So with my cortex blistering and my desperation mounting, I sat up and had me a wardrobe malfunction. I ripped off my shirt, flung it behind me, and then sat there waiting for an air conditioner to appear. Nothing. Still hot, still sweaty, still wondering if I could make it to the end. I was now a sweaty, half-naked piglet, and I just didn't care. I was on fire. Just when I knew failure was truly imminent and I would have to leave the lodge, I heard a roar, a lion of Africa, and then a howl from the Lakota Plains, the lodge filled with their sounds. Roar, ooh, roar, ooh. The unending beat of the drum, the hiss of the ancestors. Roar, ooh, roar, ooh. My ears filled with this noise. My skin was blistering. My nostrils filled with steam. My heart was galloping in my chest, and I was mad. But I needed to survive. I wanted desperately to be a warrior. And it was then, in that madness, I found what I needed to survive. I dug deep. And when I came up, it wasn't a lion or a wolf. It was the voice of Sammy, my miniature poodle, and his high-pitched bark. It was the only thing I could do. I barked, yeep! And then I barked louder, yeep, yeep, until I was barking at the top of my steam-filled lungs. Roar, hoo, yeep, roar, hoo, yeep. It could have been 5 minutes. It could have been 5 years. I had no idea. But then suddenly, it all stopped. No song, no drum, no lions, no wolves, no poodle. Just like that, it was over. The flap opened. Cool air and sunlight rushed in, and then reality hit me. Where did I put my shirt? In seconds, I found it, crawled out of the anepi, found a stump, and sat down. It was over. Later, we ate our sacred food of corn, squash, and beans. It had really been a good day. I had honored Miguel, and me, I had found my inner poodle. And in the process, I had become a warrior.
T.O. Martha Eshelman is thankful to her family and friends for their constant support in her many adventures. She is particularly thankful that Miguel is in the audience tonight and sends him her love. In our final story of the night, it's the first of our two grand prize winning stories, where Holland Colclasure learns a thing or two at summer camp in Finding Jesus.
I was 13, Cherokee, red-faced in Hot Springs Village at Brook Hill Ranch, a Christian camp. One of the head counselors, Brian, was saying some prayer of thankfulness. I was the only person with open eyes, watching everyone conform to the dogmatic rules of prayer. Nope. I glazed at their others' eyes, seeing them tighten. Perhaps they thought Jesus could hear them better if they're tightening their eyes. I stared at their lips, trying to read them, to understand for what they were praying. If they were asking for anything at all, if simply they were just moving their lips in case counselors were inspecting them, making sure they were being good Christians. I wondered if they were praying for their dying grandmother. I wondered if they were praying to be noticed, to make a friend. I wondered if they were praying for a kiss, the feel of a bare breast against palm. I wondered if they prayed to get the third base. I didn't understand prayer, the point, the act, the ridiculousness of talking to a son of an invisible man who was actually a ghost. I sat quietly and noticed Delaney from Baton Rouge. Her long blonde braids rested serenely against her chest. Her Louisiana skin smelled of honeysuckle and the slightest summer breeze. And I saw her sunset smile as I looked up from her thighs, and the guilt of surveying her body rested in that moment of visual contact. I tapped Brad on the knee and said, "That Delaney kid is smiling at me." He whispered, "Shut up, you're gonna get us in trouble." "Calm down, I'm gonna mouth the words olive juice," I said. "Olive juice, what the hell? If you mouth it, it looks like I love you." "Oh, that's brilliant," he said, with his eyes still closed. "Shut up, you're gonna get us in trouble." I looked at Delaney. I mouthed olive juice. Her smile matured to a luminous gleam against the newborn moonlight as the July stars stretched and peeked their heads from night's cloak, kissing the sun good day. "Amen," Brian said. "Amen," said the crowd. I walked towards Delaney with my half-crooked smile. I ate a line drive at third base a month before, so I wore a bridge. Basically, two front teeth attached to the end of a retainer. "Hiya, my name is Holland, like the country," I told her and stuck out my hand to be shaken. "I know who you are," she said and shook my hand. "My name is Delaney Coffee, like the drink." A calm, warm energy surged through my palm, up my forearm, and faded at my shoulder's top. "You have beautiful blue eyes," she said. "Thank you, so do you," I told her. I was nervous. I wanted to tell her that I loved her. I wanted to tell her that I thought she was the most beautiful girl I had ever met. I wanted to tell her that when she smiled, I smiled, that probably the entire world felt her smile, felt her warmth, the radiant gorgeousness that she was. I wanted to tell her she was the sun. I wanted to tell her how beautiful her legs were. I watched the brown in the sun as she walked barefoot in the long blades of grass. I leaned closer. Her eyes glanced down for a moment of tenderness, and she looked back up. Both of our blue eyes analyzed each other's readiness. I placed my left hand gently against the back of her neck. The soft blonde hairs moist with night. Rested my right hand against her left cheek and pulled her against my chest for our first kiss together. Our lips touched. I tasted the day's salt and the hint of spearmint as she opened her mouth slightly and glided her tongue gently across mine. She grabbed both my cheeks and kissed me hard on the mouth. "You have the sweetest legs," I told her. "I love you too," she said, and smiled and turned towards the calling of her name. "I'll be right there." And our fingers pulled away. And I watched her run in the dark as her brown legs faded into shadows. "Come on, let's get to the bunk," Brad said. All the guys were playing poker for candy and snacks. And I sat on the top bunk and stared and started writing Delaney a letter. I grabbed a piece of beef jerky from the pack and took a bite. I immediately heard the snap and felt the hard porcelain as I bit down. I broke the two teeth in my bridge and there was no escaping the gap left behind. "Oh crap, oh crap," I said, and I felt gutted. My stomach bubbled, my hands sweated, my heart buried itself deep inside me before embarrassment and humiliation settled. I felt like weeping, but I held back and I told the bunk what happened. They told me don't worry about it. It was no big deal, but they didn't have to kiss anyone goodbye the next day, the last day of camp. I knew I couldn't kiss her goodbye, looking like a rube. I avoided Delaney all day, except for the few waves in the passing. And after dinner, the carnival began, and hay rides at dusk. I must have been the only camper not wanting to participate, but I found myself in the middle of the chaos. Delaney walked to me and asked, "Where have you been? Why haven't you talked to me?" I put my head down and whispered in her ear, "I broke my fake teeth last night, and I felt embarrassed. Look like a hillbilly." She looked confused. "Let me see," she said. I stepped back and opened my mouth. She grabbed my hand. "Come on." We walked to the marriage booth and we got married 8 times with aluminum foil wedding bands. She held my hand and we walked around as whispers echoes and laughs followed. And she never made me feel ugly. And we sat on that hayride together. We were unruffled. We shared a kiss. We kissed all night. Laughed and sat holding each other until we were made to part. Before we returned to our small lives and our small towns, we gathered for the morning prayer and to say our goodbyes. I watched as white kids cried and their eyes welled in front of counselors. I heard one kid say, "Thank you, I found Jesus this weekend." And he was weeping and he looked to be in pain. Finding Jesus must have hurt. I didn't find Jesus that week, nor have I found him today. What I found was Delaney's breast in my hand and a summer-warm hayride kiss that tasted of cheap strawberry chapstick and the bubbleless zest of orange soda from a crinkled Dixie cup. And we sat together in our secret pack of summer love. And we found each other. We found our first kiss together. We found our last kiss together. We found the true spirit residing in us, but it wasn't Jesus.
Holland M. Colclasure, a Cherokee author, has read at the Arkansas Literary Festival and can be found online at Native Literatures Generations. Holland is working on his collection of short stories, There's Nobody Here But Us Indians, and teaches composition at UALR. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Sammy said we ought to put our fingers in the pie. Ran away and left me with the sugar on my. Sammy's over yonder just laughing in stitches, and I'm the one to get the switch and pull down my britches. When I got done crying, sent to sitting in the square, shooting little Lucy some hey there stares. Sammy turned the corner, still laughing about the pie. Saw me look at Lucy, went and socked me in the eye. Sammy treat me kind, it's about dinner time that you treat me kind. Burger with fries and a pickle. Forgot my pockets didn't have a nickel. The cashier grabbed me by the collar, about to give the cops a holler, but Sammy on a dime threw the dude a few dollars. Sammy treat me kind, it's about darn time that you treat me kind. Sammy, why'd you change your mind and finally try to treat me sweet? Is it 'cause the way I part my hair and always try to look so neat? Well, is it 'cause the way I always keep my head in everything I do? She said, it's nothing of the sort, I'm just in love with you. Sammy, treat me kind, it's about darn time. Sammy, treat me kind, it's about darn time that you treat me kind. Tales
from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones, and our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.